Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. In that battle space, of course, the United States Congress plays an incredibly important part. And I'm very pleased to say we have with us for our first guest a member of the Congress, senior member. He is serving from the 4th District of Oklahoma. His name is Tom Cole. He is a member of the Appropriations Committee and of particular interest to us, its Defense and Foreign Operations Subcommittees, also a member of the House Budget Committee. Congressman Tom Cole, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us, sir.
Hey, Frank. Thank you.
The news of the day, of course, is that the Obama administration seems to be plunging us into the war, really the civil war, that has been underway now for some time in Syria. You have expressed some concerns about uncertainty in American foreign policy leadership. How do you feel about this direction, and where do you think it's going to leave us?
Well, I'm very worried about it. Frankly, I don't think we've had a very clear Syrian policy. And this is beginning to look an awful lot like a slippery slope. It's hard to find good guys in the Syrian conflict. I have no sympathy with Assad, and frankly think that, he was certainly involved in killing lots of Americans when we were in Iraq, and it's been difficult throughout the region. So I shed no tears there. On the other hand, there's a lot of folks that are against him that aren't particularly savory characters either. We don't have a clear idea of what an end game in Syria is really going to be. And I don't think there's any shortage of weapons in Syria. I mean, frankly, there's plenty of Arab states that are pumping plenty of guns and have the ability to put, frankly, very sophisticated weapons in the hands of the rebels if they so choose. So I don't see a compelling reason for the United States to be involved in this way at this time.
Yeah. We're hearing from some of the Obama folks, specifically Samantha Power, the woman the president has nominated to become the next UN ambassador, that there's a kind of responsibility to protect, and that that's kind of what's operating here as much as anything, some 92,000 people having lost their lives. Do you think that our involvement, Congressman Tom Cole, is likely to reduce civilian casualties, or do you think it might make it worse?
No, I think that probably will. I mean, anything that prolongs the conflict is not going to, quote, protect anybody. And there's no reason to believe there's going to be a democratic outcome on the other side of this where there's all of a sudden a renaissance in human rights in Syria, no matter who wins. So I think you have to be pretty brutal and look at this in terms of American interests. And getting pulled into something like this step by step, I find it hard to believe is in our interest. Samantha Powers was also a leading advocate for what we did in Libya, which I think was a disaster. We committed American force without even congressional approval, but beyond that, we had a regime, unsavory to be sure, but al-Qaeda was not operating in this territory. It had given up its nuclear materials, its WMDs. Gaddafi was actually trying to work his way back into international respectability. We overthrew that regime. And again, I had no love for Gaddafi, but if the rebels could have done it themselves, that's fine. But since they couldn't, we intervened. What do we have now? We have a lawless state. We have 4 Americans dead. We have loose weapons flowing all over the region, and we hardly have a reliable ally or friend. So, it looks to me in Syria like a replay, except a much more dangerous one with a much more important country and a much more vicious conflict.
Yeah, and with far wider regional implications almost certainly. I want to commend you, Congressman Tom Cole, from the 4th District of Oklahoma for, among other things, your co-sponsorship of the resolution Frank Wolf has introduced to try to get a special select committee to investigate that Libya thing. But you're absolutely right. I'm afraid we're going to see this in spades in Syria if we're not careful. And again, without apparently congressional authorization other than the cheerleading of Senator John McCain and a few others in the Senate for all of this. You have responsibilities, I mentioned, Congressman Cole, for overseeing and providing for the common defense in your capacity as a member of the House Appropriations Committee's Defense Subcommittee. The prospect of not just arming rebels, but apparently some kind of no-fly zone or no-go zone enforced from the air that is evidently also being contemplated by the administration is coming against the backdrop, as you know so well, of serious hollowing out of our military. And I just wonder what your thoughts are as to the impact that plunging ourselves even incrementally into another war in the Middle East is likely to have on what's left of the only military we have.
We're on a very dangerous path. Even pre-sequester, basically because of budget constraints, we're downsizing the American Army by about 70,000 troops by 2017. I mean, that drops it from about 565 to about 490. We'll have about 20,000 fewer Marines. We'll have seven fewer fighter wings. We'll have, probably 288 combat vessels as opposed to the 313 we're planning to have. So you look at all that, it's a really serious reduction in American capability. And there are things that we will not be able to do that, frankly, we've thought that we could do until relatively recently. We had very interesting...
And needed to do, more to the
and
point.
And needed to do, absolutely. You're going to stretch capability to the limit. So, again, I think that means you have to be doubly prudent about where you're going to be involved, because again, it is a dangerous world. We've got Iranians, we've got North Koreans, we've got a China that's building up extraordinary military capability step by step, and we've got sort of reassertive Russia out there. Not to mention any humanitarian crisis like what had happened in Japan or something, where we really have a real interest in helping an ally, and most people don't know we deployed 19 ships and used thousands of American military personnel and assets to help in Japan. A good use, by the way, of that forces. But your ability to do these kind of things is going to be progressively more and more limited. So I really worry about an administration that seems to have a rather assertive foreign policy, and yet at the same time is rapidly diminishing the military assets that are required for that. And there's no question this president will leave his successor, whoever that is, a much less capable military than George W. Bush left him.
Yes, indeed. As worrying, I guess, in some ways, is not only the kinds of numerical reductions that you're talking about in terms of the overall end strength of our forces, but also the failure to provide the training and readiness funds that are required to keep the ones that we still have able to operate. I'm thinking particularly of Air Force units and ships as well.
Oh, you are so right. This point was made pretty compellingly by General Odierno in recent testimony in front of the Defense Appropriations Committee. When we talked to him about, for instance, what the impact of sequester was going to be, and he said, "Well, if we have to do something, it's going to cost lives. We're going to put people in harm's way without giving them the kind of training and the kind of preparation that combat warfare requires." So. I'm not telling you that we won't do, we'll always go where we're asked to go or told to go and do what we're asked to do. But the cost of it in terms of lives is going to get higher because we're not doing the right things to prepare.
Yeah. Speaking of preparedness, we're told, Congressman Tom Cole, that the president is going to be making an address during his European sojourn next week in Berlin that may build on his ambition to really dramatically further cut our nuclear deterrent. To the extent that that's happening against the backdrop of a very dangerous world, either through some sort of deal with the Russians or even unilaterally, what's your view of its advisability?
Well, I think it's very inadvisable. Again, I think most people don't realize how diminished our nuclear capability is. Now, it's robust. It's the greatest in the world. But again, this is an aging nuclear capability with some pretty old delivery systems. And the idea that we're going to, again, be reducing this when it really is our ultimate deterrent, I think is one that bears thinking about. I don't know very many people that I respect in the security arena that think this is a particularly wise choice. So again, I think it fits into a broader pattern of limiting capabilities, and at the same time having rather vast ambitions to reshape the world. And pretty dangerous combination.
It is indeed. Congressman Tom Colt, we're glad you're the watchman on the wall in the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, representing again the people of Oklahoma splendidly. Keep up the good work, sir, and thank you very much for taking a few minutes to share with us your thoughts. We'll hope to talk to you again in the near future. Next up, John Hanna, former National Security Advisor to Vice President Cheney, will join us talking about Turkey, Syria, and much more. Straight ahead.
You think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. For over 7 months, the truth has been hidden about a terrorist attack that killed 4 Americans in Benghazi, Libya, last September 11th. We still don't know why our ambassador was in that dangerous place on a day Islamists have made dangerous for all of us, or why we were repeatedly told that a mob, not jihadist, killed him and his comrades, or why no effective rescue effort was mounted. So 700 of my fellow Special Forces veterans who have participated in such efforts in the past have teamed up to learn the truth and to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. To see a copy of our open letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a real investigation of Benghazi Gate and to urge your representative to do the same, go to www.inthecoverup.com, a project of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back joined by John Hanna. He served as Vice President Dick Cheney's National Security Advisor during part of his tenure, previously as his Deputy National Security Advisor. He's currently a senior fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, a columnist for a number of publications and contributors to many others, and a man that we are very privileged to have as a guest from time to time. John, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be with you.
In the previous segment, John, we were talking with Congressman Tom Cole about some concerns that he has about President Obama's announced intention to now engage militarily in assisting the rebels, as they call them, the opposition in Syria. The congressman took a rather dim view of this. What's your sense of it?
Well, I'm cautious about it, Frank. I do worry on the one hand that Iran and Hezbollah are being allowed to run rampant across the Middle East into the Levant in regions of the world that have traditionally been of vital interest to the United States. On the other hand, I'm equally concerned about the fact that that Obama's policies to this point, 2 years in, have left Al Qaeda running rampant on the other side of this. So how we now at this point, this late in the day, when all the options are so bad, begin to get into this and figure out to pick winners from losers, it just strikes me it's filled with uncertainties and perhaps even great dangers for the United States.
Yeah, you know, a perfect metaphor for this. I'm inclined now to begin merging President Obama with John McCain, who seem to be increasingly joined at the hips. Obamacain, I think, is the way to think of this. We're with John Hanna. He is the former National Security Advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney and a man who has continued to contribute mightily to our national security deliberations and debate, now in his current capacity as a senior fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracy. John, Senator McCain was unable to differentiate between terrorists he was meeting with when he was there recently. It does seem to me it's going to be down problematic to figure out who's going to get the arms and make sure that the ones we give them to don't wind up giving them to some of their friends with Al-Qaeda. Question about Muslim Brotherhood. They're another force in all of this across the Levant, as you say. Clearly seen by the administration as preferable to Al-Qaeda. Is that preferable from your point of view?
Not in my view, Frank. I mean, if we've got options here, it would be great to have the Brotherhood and the Salafists and Al-Qaeda at each other's throats, as they often are. I think we ought to encourage that dynamic. But in terms of people that we actually ought to support and want to get into power, people that can help secure and protect vital U.S. interests, to my mind, over the course of time, there's really little difference in choice between the Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda. I think both of these movements, they may have real differences between each other, but in terms of their basic principles, they're fundamentally anti-American, anti-Israeli, and pro-Sharia. And it seems to me that all of those things are, whether it's the Brotherhood or Al-Qaeda, pose an enormous threat to America and its main partners in the Middle East.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. John, let me go across the border. You have been writing lately about Turkey. It is a country, of course, that has been in the news most recently because of demonstrations against the government of Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan. You've been focusing on one piece of this story that hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention, and that is what Erdogan has been doing vis-a-vis the Kurds. And maybe if you could tie those two dramatic developments in Turkey together for us and give us sort of a prognosis of where this very important country is headed, in your judgment.
Yeah, happy to do so, Frank. Erdogan, since the beginning of this year, has sought to address what has legitimately been the real Achilles heel of the Turkish Republic for much of its 90 years of history. That is its fundamental problem with its very large Kurdish minority that has been dissatisfied with its status inside of Turkey. And for the last 30 years, through the Kurdish, the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers Party, has been engaged in a long-running, very vicious, very violent terrorist battle against the Turkish state that's cost tens of thousands of lives. But since the beginning of this year, Erdogan, in an effort to resolve this problem, largely based on his own political calculations and ambition to become Turkey's next president by rewriting its constitution, has decided to try and make peace, to make take a major gamble, make peace with the PKK and Erdogan, try and put the Kurdish conflict to bed, win a huge Kurdish constituency in terms of votes, to change the constitution, to create a dramatically newly empowered presidency, that Erdogan himself with his desires to occupy that and then rule Turkey basically unchecked for the next 10 years to implement his Islamist agenda.
Yeah, this does not sound altogether positive from our perspective, John. I mean, the Kurds have been a long-suffering minority, both in Turkey, of course, and in Syria and in Iraq and elsewhere. So relieving their situation is probably a good thing for not only them, but for the region. But what about Erdogan's ambitions and the agenda of transforming his country even further into an Islamist enterprise and perhaps a regional hegemon as a result?
Yeah, no, I think it. I have great ambivalence about this peace process because I agree, like you, Frank, that it's critical for Turkey, a NATO ally, to finally get on top of this Kurdish problem and put it to bed. I think it'll be in the long run, good for Kurdish democracy and Kurdish prosperity and security. On the other hand, it is clearly tied to this agenda that's been under this project that's been underway for the last 10 years, run by Erdogan and his party, the AKP, to fundamentally transform Turkey from the vision of its founder, the secular democratic republic, into an autocratic Islamist and at its root anti-American dictatorship. And I think that has great dangers for the United States and something that we need to be extremely wary of.
Well, again, I find myself in complete agreement with you. John, let me turn quickly in a closing minutes to another issue that I know during your time with Vice President Cheney, you were very much aware of and involved in, namely developing capabilities to monitor transmissions of various kinds by enemies of this country. Now that has come to light, thanks to Edward Snowden, in connection with several national security agency programs. How serious is the fact that these programs have been made public and that we may wind up seeing them as a result compromised?
Yeah, I think it would be a huge tragedy coming out of this whole event if, in fact, these programs are delegitimized and dramatically cut back. I think my view has been, Frank, that we are in a real global war here, that these programs have been essential to protecting the United States since 9/11. I think they are entirely legitimate and constitutional, involve all the branches of our government playing their appropriate roles, including our elected representatives who are accountable to the people every 2 or 4 years. So to see these programs compromised at this point in time, I think, would be an enormous tragedy and a detriment to the safety of the American people.
John, thank you. We're going to have to leave it at that. John Hanna, former National Security Advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney, now with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Keep up the good work. We look forward to visiting with you often. John, thank you so much, and take care. Next up, Fred Grandy joins us. We'll get his take on Syria and the scandals and much, much more.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The White House says the Syrian government breached President Obama's red lines, after all, by using chemical weapons. So having unilaterally abandoned Iraq and Afghanistan in the name of ending wars, Mr. Obama is unilaterally getting us into a new one, a civil war no less, by providing military assistance to Syria's al-Qaeda-dominated rebels. Welcome to the responsibility to protect, a notion embraced by some on Team Obama, like Samantha Power, the president's controversial nominee to be our next UN ambassador. She and other promoters of R2P, as it's known, believe military force should be used, but only where we have no interests. Tragically, applying it here will embroil us in a wider war doomed to make Mr. Obama's previous R2P debacle in Benghazi and elsewhere in Libya pale by comparison. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them.
When you make fun of them.
When you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday morning from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Fred Grandy. He is a senior fellow, I'm very pleased to say, at the Center for Security Policy, observing and commenting and helping otherwise address national security affairs. Former member of Congress for four terms. Representing the people of Iowa, he is a man of many parts, including on stage and screen, and not least, he is an extraordinary, gifted, and very capable radio personality. So we're always grateful to have him with us. Fred, welcome back. It's good to talk with you.
Thank you, sir.
We have before the House the question of Syria, and I've been discussing with our previous guests their take on what Obamacare has getting us into there. I'd be very interested in your take on it, Fred. Is this an advisable intervention, perhaps initially of a fairly modest kind, but almost certainly to grow over time?
Well, I don't think it's a good decision. I don't think it's ever been a good decision. There were never any good choices, but now there seem to be only bad ones. I mean, supposedly we are going to be aiding the rebels. That presumes, of course, that we know exactly who the rebels are in terms of the spectrum alliance between pro-West and pro-Islam, and that hasn't been determined for me. But I mean, there are a couple of things that make me wonder why now, Mr. President, and of course there is that fatwa by Yusuf Kardawi that all of a sudden makes it very much in keeping with a pro jihadist sentiment to intervene, which, of course, unfortunately has guided this administration in the past, particularly in Libya and elsewhere. But the other thing, Frank, and this is domestic politics, which, of course, always captures my imagination. This seemed to follow right on the heels of Bill Clinton coming out and saying, I agree with John McCain. We should have done something. And what the president is not doing here reminds me of Rwanda. Somehow, for politicians, there's a spectrum between Iraq and Rwanda in terms of intervention, which I think is bogus, but seems to dictate a lot of political decision making. But I'm just wondering if the fact that Clinton is now supposedly saying we should have done something and we still should do something indicates a weakening in Obama's political status within his own party. And unfortunately, rightly or wrongly, that sometimes trips a trigger more often than an international event. I know that sounds cynical, but I think it's true.
Well, it's the kind of political acumen that we rely upon you to provide, Fred Grandy, as you have it in spades. One of the things that, I guess you could also stitch into that, of course, is President Clinton having fiddled while Bosnia burned for a long time, threw himself into that. And, of course, also there's the Hillary factor, trying to set up her presidential campaign and bid. I'm struck, going back to the Karadawi point that you've made, Steve Coughlin, one of our distinguished colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, has driven much of my thinking on this with his analysis of sort of the timelines that the Muslim Brotherhood, Qaeda, the Salafists, and others have essentially established over this trajectory of the so-called Arab Spring. And it does seem as though Karadawi is of course, a overarching influence, the sheikh out of Qatar, who is one of the chief ideologues of these guys, and that and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation calling for a no-fly zone, I think on the 3rd of June, all suggest that we're under direction of some kind here as much as anything. Fred, let me turn to the other major topic du jour, and that is this seemingly cascading series of scandals that is rocking the Obama administration, the latest involving State Department security guards and an ambassador and Hillary Clinton, speaking of her security detail. What's going on here with that and the IRS and AP Gate and on and on?
Well, I think what we're seeing now, again, going back to what we're talking about before, is the unraveling of kind of the omerta that prevailed in the Obama administration about don't speak out, don't reveal any secrets. And I think now a lot of people are coming forward and saying, look, there's been a lot of collusion and corruption going on. I mean, this kind of behavior in the State Department is not a new thing. And it has always been one of the jobs of political appointees to make sure that careerists in these departments kept their mouths shut so that they didn't embarrass their higher-ups. But, of course, what we're seeing now, I think, is a tearing of that fabric. You're absolutely right. Hillary Clinton is one of the, I think, one of the principal victims of this because it was her trip to South America, I recall, where we first began hearing about possibly connections between her detail and prostitutes and things of that nature. So,
you may be conflating the problem that the president and his security detail had in Colombia, as I recall. But this is you're right. This has certainly been rife. And one of the things that another of our colleagues, Joseph Schmitz, has pointed out is, you know, where's the IG in all of this? And it seems as though, according to Joe, there's been a deliberate effort to keep one from being presidentially appointed and Senate confirmed. And that may have contributed to a latitude here.
The others appear to have been neutered. I mean, those IGs were put in place as ombudsmen to make sure that these departments functioned appropriately within constitutional guidelines.
Interestingly, usually at the initiative of the left, as you know, Fred, from your time.
Absolutely. But what appears to have happened is they've been co-opted again by a kind of a political class that exists above the careerists and up to this point has been pretty successful in suppressing whatever comments they wanted to make.
Yeah. Speaking of Omerta, the code of silence, Fred Grandy, there's a very interesting piece by Matt Cottinetti in the Washington Free Beacon today, and I wanted to get your thoughts on it. He describes at length kind of the genealogy of the incest between the Obama administration at myriad levels and senior people in the press, television, radio, the written press, you name it. How serious a factor has this been in the failure to date of the press to hold the administration accountable or otherwise do its job as a kind of watchdog in the absence of these IGs?
Going back to our allusion to gangland and the mafia, obviously family is everything. And if you have one member of your family who's working in a high-level security position at the White House like Ben Rhodes and another who is his brother who's a high-ranking network executive, you have to assume that conversations include the kind of details that go on in those closed circles. Now, unfortunately, this is not a new thing. It's been going on for some time, and I think one of the real culprits here is the media has actively been courting reporters who come out of the administration to become people like George Stephanopoulos or Chuck Todd, who of course is the White House correspondent for NBC, who worked for Tom Harkin for years. And what that creates is a kind of family business within the business of government that conspires against openness. And the only reason I think we know more about it now is because we have social media and the internet and ways to kind of penetrate the security blanket that has been thrown over this town for a long time. The other factor that I think is important here is, to some degree, when he was president, again, Bill Clinton and his wife, I think, kind of exalted the whole concept of the power couple. So whether we're talking about them or we're talking about Jay Carney and Claire Shipman or Mary Madeline and James Carville, all of a sudden that seems to be a kind of unit of decision making that ordinarily should be shunned because there's obviously a compromise of interest, but is now courted.
Right. Another power couple that comes to mind, of course, is Anthony Weiner and his wife, Huma Abedin, formerly the deputy chief of staff to Hillary Clinton as well. Fred, I think your point is very well taken here, that we've got conversations that are taking place probably between these family members, pillow talk in some cases as well. But there's also almost certainly just this mutuality of interest. That you don't want to see the administration in which your family members serve scandalized or run through the mud. And that's got to be serving as a break on the kind of honest, objective, independent reportage that the founders of this republic certainly had in mind a free press performing. Fred, you certainly pull no punches on all of these matters. We are very grateful to you for taking some time with us here at Secure Freedom Radio each week, and we look forward to talking with you again next week. We'll be talking next up with Bill Gertz, our guy inside the ring. We'll want to make sure you know what he knows about what's going on in the national security arena straight after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. For over 7 months, the truth has been hidden about a terrorist attack that killed 4 Americans in Benghazi, Libya, last September 11th. We still don't know why our ambassador was in that dangerous place on a day Islamists have made dangerous for all of us, or why we were repeatedly told that a mob, not jihadist, killed him and his comrades, or why no effective rescue effort was mounted. So 700 of my fellow Special Forces veterans who have participated in such efforts in the past have teamed up to learn the truth and to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. To see a copy of our open letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a real investigation of Benghazi Gate and to urge your representative to do the same, go to www.inthecoverup.com, a project of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaevs' kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Bill Gertz, as we are each week. I'm very happy to say at this point in the program, he tells us what's going on inside the ring, the name of his must-reading column at the Washington Times. He is also a senior editor with the Washington Free Beacon. And Bill, as ever, you've been doing some superb reporting on this National Security Agency scandal. Maybe we could start by talking about what General Alexander, the commander of the National Security Agency and Cyber Command, told Congress this week about that episode and about the capabilities that have been compromised as a result of Edward Snowden's disclosure.
Yeah, hi, Frank. Good to be on the program. Yeah, General Alexander, who's the head of the U.S. Cyber Command and also the director of the National Security Agency, gave a spirited defense before lawmakers on Capitol Hill this week, basically defending the U.S. surveillance program and discussing some of the damage that's already been done. The real concern, according to Pentagon officials I talked to, is that Snowden, the former NSA contractor, is in Hong Kong, which is enemy territory in terms of intelligence gathering. And There are serious concerns that he will, in fact, barter some of the highly classified electronic intelligence programs that he is aware of in order to gain asylum in Hong Kong. China so far has been very silent on the affair. I imagine there's a big debate going on right now and among the collective dictatorship that rules China. The discussion would be, should we help the Americans get this guy back, or should we use him for intelligence purposes? I think they're going to come down on the side of the latter. I don't think Ed Snowden is going to leave Hong Kong anytime soon.
Yeah, I think that's probably right, or maybe even wind up elsewhere in the mainland. But at the very least, we can fully expect he will be debriefed, shall we say, if he is going to be released at all. It'll be after that takes place, I'm sure. And you've written, Bill Gertz, about what appears to be evidence among certain jihadist circles that there has already been damage done to our capabilities in this regard. Now that they've been made known.
Yes, U.S. intelligence agencies closely monitor jihadist websites, and they've already seen postings which have discussed the idea of changing passwords and using encryption software and other stronger security measures to avoid detection. This is going to make it more difficult for U.S. intelligence agencies to monitor terrorist activities. It's not going to end it, but it'll just make it more difficult. It seems to be some of the initial damage from the disclosures by Snowden.
To the extent that this is really part of a larger problem, Bill Gertz, of both compromises of very sensitive intelligence capabilities and the penetration of our computer systems, notably by China's own military arms dedicated for this purpose. Was this given the kind of prominence that you would have expected? First of all, that Snowden turns out to be in China and that the hacking is emanating from Chinese sources in large measure on the shirt sleeve summit agenda.
Well, you know, the president raised the issue at the very final meeting with Xi Jinping of Chinese cyber attacks, and the response he got was a shoulder shrug from Xi. Basically, the reason here is that the Chinese cyber attack capabilities, which is done mainly by the military, is one of the most secret programs. It's what we in the U.S. call an unacknowledged program. In other words, They lie about the existence of the program. So his initial response was to lie to the president and say that we are not doing this, and that this is you know, that we're all victims of international cyber attacks. So it's in the same category as their anti-satellite programs. They've also denied, despite having shot down a satellite in 2007, they deny that they have any satellite weapons program. So this is clearly an indicator that the relationship that the Obama administration is seeking with China is still far away from being any kind of a close relationship.
Yeah. And I guess this is a part of the larger question I've been talking about now for months, Bill, as to whether we are responding appropriately to the undisguised aggressiveness of communist China. If the summit didn't work out exactly the way the Obama administration hoped, do you think that there's going to be more of a willingness to reconsider what has been to this point pretty much a hollow pivot, to use that expression, as well as the larger problem that that causes it, namely the hollowing out of our military?
Well, yeah, and I also want to mention, too, I had a piece this week that was based on the president's new directive on cyber warfare called PDD-20. And if you read that story in the Free Beacon, you'd see that the entire focus is on defensive measures. Even when engaged in cyber warfare as part of military operations, the total emphasis is on defense, which many observers say is a losing strategy. You're never going to be, nobody has ever won a war playing defense. You have to be able to have offensive capabilities as well.
At least as a deterrent. Bill, now, do you think that there's a classified aspect of this that was not in that memo that would recognize the need for
it? No, it was a top secret. It was a top secret directive that was disclosed by Snowden. So it basically lays out the whole, and again, it's you know, the administration has been under fire from industry to say, look, you've got to do something because we are getting killed by foreign cyber attacks, mainly from China. So it's still a big problem, and they have not addressed it because of the administration's kind of postmodern view that, you know, that they can cooperate with enemy states like Iran and China and North Korea.
If only we engage them aggressively enough. Bill, let me turn to another subject that, again, you're deeply expert on. Russia has announced that they've tested a missile that has the capability to defeat our missile defenses. This comes as we're seeing the run-up to the president meeting with Vladimir Putin, at which I imagine there will be further conversations about how the United States can accommodate Russian concerns about missile defenses. And also, we're told, a speech in Berlin in which he may telegraph that we're cutting our missile not only our missile defense, but our nuclear forces even further, either in concert with the Russians or perhaps unilaterally. What do we know about what's going to be on the agenda next week, and how bad do you think it'll be?
I think it's going to be very bad. According to officials that I've talked to, the administration's strategy is to try to make further concessions on missile defense as a way to dispose of the issue completely so that the president can then announce a plan to cut our nuclear forces even further. And so that seems to be the pattern that's emergent. The president is going to meet Vladimir Putin on the 17th at the summit, the G8 summit. And or is it the G20 summit? Anyway, it's a major economic summit coming up. The Russian press has clearly stated that missile defense and nuclear issues will be one of it, and that they expect as many as three different agreements to be reached at this. As of yet, we don't know what they are, but from a national security standpoint, I think that it's going to be very detrimental to U.S. Security interests with these further concessions that are coming down the pike.
Especially if they are made unilaterally, as I think it seems to be a distinct possibility. Finally, Bill, we only have about half a minute. Quickly, General Odierno, the Chief of Staff of the Army, made a rather surprising announcement, it appears, as to what the primary mission of the Army is these days. What is it?
Yeah, a senior Army officer was at a command briefing recently and was told that the main mission of the Army now is to stop sexual assaults. And, of course, this was surprising to many who believe that the Army's constitutional mission is to provide for the common defense. And I raised this with Army Public Affairs. And so this is, again, it's affecting the entire armed services, this push to end sexual assault, which is a problem, but certainly shouldn't detract from the ability to fight and win the nation's war.
Unfortunately, it does, I'm afraid. Bill Gertz, we have to let it go with that. Thank you for joining us. As always, keep up the great work. We'll talk with you again next week. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, as well, next week. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.